from Pacifica Radio. This is Democracy Now!
My history was segregated and presented to me as a whole when it was not whole.
Randall Robinson critiques African American History Month and talks about slavery, whitewashing the past. Also, the FBI arrests suspected terrorists in Los Angeles. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. A report recommending reparations to about 120 elderly survivors of the Tulsa race riot of 1921, one of the worst mob attacks on African Americans in U.S. history, went to Oklahoma Governor Frank Keating yesterday, setting the stage for a possible legislative battle. Keating, who said he'd not yet reviewed the 200-page document in its entirety, repeated that he favored reparations if the report contained persuasive evidence of government involvement in the massacre. Compiled by a state commission, the report reconstructs the white mob assault that left Tulsa's thriving Greenwood District, also called the Negro Wall Street of America by Booker T. Washington, a smoldering ruin with as many as 300 people dead. The Oklahoma legislature is split over whether to follow the example of Florida lawmakers who in 1994 paid $150,000 each to survivors and descendants of a 1923 white attack on the black town of Rosewood. If it approves reparations, Oklahoma would be only the second U.S. state after Florida to compensate black victims of white mob violence that erupted in dozens of places across the nation in the first part of the 20th century. Still suffering the aftermath of state-sanctioned discrimination, three of Maryland's historically black colleges will receive millions of state dollars to make their campuses the equals of their traditionally white counterparts. The state's public university system decided Tuesday to commit about $16 million so Bowie State University, Coppin State College, and the University of Maryland Eastern Shore can upgrade their academic programs, facilities, and equipment. The moves came 2 months after Maryland and the U.S. Education Department's Office of Civil Rights agreed to sweep away any trace of the state's once segregated higher education system. The federal government has formed similar pacts with most of the states, including Alabama, Florida, and Georgia, that once segregated their higher education systems by state law. Two lawsuits filed Tuesday demand compensation from Japanese conglomerates that allegedly used thousands of Koreans as slave laborers before and during World War II. The suits assert that Mitsubishi and Mitsui subsidiaries didn't pay Koreans for work in coal mines, factories, and shipbuilding operations from 1931 to 1945. The Los Angeles lawsuits are the latest in a series that seek reparations for those who were forced to labor for companies that fueled the German and Japanese war efforts. Some researchers have identified 135 Japanese companies which used slave labor. California became a magnet for such cases 2 years ago when a new law allowed victims of slave labor to sue multinational corporations operating in the state until the year 2010. A Chinese corporation pleaded guilty in U.S. District Court in Trenton, New Jersey, yesterday to charges that millions of office supplies it shipped to the United States were made by prisoners. Through its attorney, Allied International Manufacturing Stationery Company of Nanjing admitted that at least 134 million office binder clips shipped to the United States have been assembled by 60 prisoners. Most of them were imprisoned for prostitution. According to court records, the company turned to prison labor in 1995 after its American customers demanded more of the binders. U.S. law forbids importing goods made by prison or forced labor and was designed to curb human rights abuses and to protect U.S. businesses and laborers from unfair competition. Burma, which has been governed by a military junta for more than a dozen years, is rapidly increasing apparel exports to the United States despite American economic sanctions. A newly declassified State Department cable describes how factories in Burma have produced garments for leading American designers and retailers, including Kenneth Cole, Nautica, Jordache, Kmart, and Walmart. The cable, written by the American Embassy in Burma's capital, voices concern that Burma's military leaders are benefiting financially from these shipments because most of the factories are joint ventures partly owned by the military government. In 1999, the cable said Burma exported $168 million worth of garments to the United States, but those shipments more than doubled last year, soaring to more than $400 million worth. 4 years ago, President Clinton banned new American investments in Burma, but the government has not banned all trade, merely encouraging companies not to do business there. The Washington Post reports after 5 months of violence in the West Bank and Gaza, Israeli military and civilian officials have concluded that the situation is no longer tenable and they will have to do something about it soon. Among options being discussed is the possibility of reoccupying territory controlled by Yasser Arafat's Palestinian Authority. This, according to Israeli sources.
No more auction block for me. No more, no more. No more auction block for me. Many salt for me, no more, no more, no more pint of salt for me, many
listening to Paul Robeson singing No More Auction Block here on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! And in just a few minutes, we'll be hearing a speech given just a few days ago by TransAfrica founder Randall Robinson on reparations. But first, this news. Yesterday, the FBI arrested seven Iranians on charges of raising more than $1 million for the main Iranian opposition group, People's Mujahideen Organization. Group members allegedly posed as charity workers at Los Angeles Airport to solicit funds for starving orphans. The FBI charged the funds went to purchase arms. Also known as the Mujahideen al-Haq, or MEK, the group is listed as a terrorist organization by Washington. Reuters reported the MEK has carried out several rocket attacks and assassinations in Iran's big cities in recent months as part of a campaign to overthrow the Islamic Republic. An FBI spokesperson in Los Angeles said that, quote, none of these arrested individuals are tied to any terrorist act, either here or in the United States or overseas. MEK strongly opposes the current Iranian government and has links to Iraq. The timing of the Los Angeles arrest raises questions about a possible U.S. move to establish closer ties to Iran and end the kinds of sanctions challenged by oil interests, including Vice President Dick Cheney's former company, Halliburton. We're joined on the phone now by Dilip Hero in London. His forthcoming book is called Neighbors, Not Friend, Iraq and Iran After the Gulf Wars. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Dilip Hero.
Yeah, thank you.
Can you tell us who MEK are, who the MEK are?
Yeah, I think their name is Mujahideen al-Khalq Organization, and Khalq meaning people and organization. Now, they have been going long before the Iranian Revolution, and they were left-wing. In fact, they have tried ideologically to combine Islam with Marxism. And they were involved in the revolutionary movement against the Shah. And when the Shah fell and Ayatollah Khomeini came to power, then they wanted a share in running Iran, which Khomeini refused, and then they went against the Islamic regime, and their opposition to the Islamic regime came to a climax in June 1981, when there were street fights and so on, and at that point, their leader, Masoud Rajavi, he fled Iran and went to live in Paris, and from 1981 to 1986, the organization was based in a suburb of Paris, and of course they're very much opposed to the Islamic regime. And Then at the pressure from Tehran government, the French government expelled them from Paris, from France, and then they set up their headquarters in Baghdad under Saddam Hussein. And of course, we have to remember that at that time there was a war between Iran and Iraq from 1980 to 88, and so they became, if one can say that, Saddam's part of strategy against Iran. And they have been based there since then. They have their own armed force, and it is equipped and supplied mainly by the Iraqi government. And, of course, they also collect a lot of money abroad. And 2 years ago, they were put on the list of terrorist organizations by the State Department. And that means they can no longer collect money in America. And before that, of course, the Mujahideen-e-Khalq had an extremely powerful lobby, especially in the U.S. Congress. The U.S. Congress, any number of times, passed resolutions applauding the Mujahideen-e-Khalq for trying to accelerate what they call democratization in Iran. So that particular standing has been lost by the Mujahideen-e-Khalq once they were put on the terrorist list about 2 years ago.
What about the significance of the United States government arresting them now?
Yeah, I think that's a very important signal that's being given that, you know, things are going to ease up on Iran. You see, interestingly enough, when, as you know, every year the State Department releases a list which is the list of the terrorist organizations, and of course you can be added to it or you can be taken off from there. And so when this was first done, the question was put to the spokesman for the State Department, James Rubin. And he said, yes, of course we have done it, but this has nothing to do with our relations with Iran. But of course any such thing, you know, cannot be seen in isolation. And I'm quite certain that if they were collecting money, and please just keep in mind, why Los Angeles? Because as you know, of the 1.25 million Iranians or people of Iranian origin who live in the U.S., about 500,000 live in California. And California has a very strong, among the Iranian exiles, pro-monarchist groups, as well as, of course, those who support the Mujahideen-e-Khalq. And so, naturally, I don't think that their activities of collecting money just went down once they went on the banned list. But the question of, you know, apprehending a certain number of people and publicizing it in this way means that the Washington, D.C. is giving a signal to Tehran that we want to improve relations. And the two other things to keep in mind, Amy, are that, you know, there was an executive order signed by the U.S. president, that was Clinton, in March 1995, which banned U.S. trade with Iran. And that executive order has to be renewed every year. And that renewal is coming up fairly soon because it's from May to May. And therefore, President Bush Jr. has to make up his mind whether he wants to renew this or not. Secondly, there is a U.S. Congress law called Iran-Libya Sanctions Act, which was passed in August 1996. It's a five-year law, and it would expire in August 2001 unless U.S. Congress decides to extend it maybe on a yearly basis. And therefore, the two things are coming together very closely, and the U.S. Congress will also be watching if Mr. Bush Jr. is going to renew the executive order. And I think this is a signal to the Iran that, you know, things could ease up. And please, we have to remember one thing, that unlike Iraq, against which there are any number of resolutions against Iraq at the UN Security Council, there's not a single resolution against Iran by the UN Security Council or any other UN body. Iran is a normal member of the UN. Iran has excellent economic and diplomatic relations with the European Union, and the American policy against Iran is very unilateral policy, you know, including Canada has good relations with Iran. And so I think that my guess is that revision of this policy is in the offing, and this is the first signal that America would ease up, mainly because, see, it's again, you know, it's money, it's economics. As we speak, the French and the British oil companies are doing a raging business in Iran. Iran has 1/10 or 10% of the world oil reserves, and it has the second largest gas reserves after Russia in the world. And naturally, of course, you know, oil companies and gas companies want to do business, but American companies cannot do business because of this executive order and because of ILSA. And so, of course, Mr. Dick Cheney was the CEO of Halliburton. He had signed a petition to the White House along with other such people that sanctions against Iran should be lifted. Of course, since he became a political candidate and now vice president, he hasn't opened his mouth on the subject, and of course he would not. But I think on the whole, things should ease up between America and Iran for the reasons I explained. There's nothing against Iran at the UN, and secondly, American oil companies are losing out to the French and the British companies.
Well, DeLapierre, I want to thank you very much for being with us again. Author of Sharing the Promised Land, Tale of Israelis and Palestinians, his forthcoming book, Neighbors Not Friends, Iraq and Iran After the Gulf Wars. And you are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, DeLapierre speaking to us from London. The 28 days that America devotes to black history have come to an end, and Women's History Month has begun. But before we shift our focus, today we're going to play a speech by Randall Robinson in which he criticizes the very idea of devoting a single month to the history of groups that have been whitewashed out of official narratives. Randall Robinson is the founder of TransAfrica and author of The Debt, What America Owes to Blacks. He also argues that reparations are a way to achieve racial justice. Tomorrow, we'll take an in-depth look at two institutions, which at least in the United States have not yet been considered for reparations, the Rhodes Trust, which funds the Rhodes Scholarships, and De Beers, the International Diamond Mining Corporation, which Cecil Rhodes founded. But today, Randall Robinson's speech, which he gave just a few days ago at the community bookstore devoted to Africana in Brooklyn, New York, called Indico Cafe and Books. Randall Robinson speaking recently about African American History Month. We're going to go back to that speech after the break here on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We go back now to TransAfrica founder Randall Robinson.
And much of the discussion can help America to repair itself. But in the last analysis, how we come out of this discussion may have a lot to do with the future of this country and whether this society can cohere and survive as a society. It's important to note that while America perceives itself now, mistakenly, as a white country, a European country, that we are in our demographics dramatically moving away from that in a way that will make a new truth virtually undeniable in the space of a very few years. So that sometime in the middle of this century, blacks, Hispanics, Asian Americans, Native Americans will comprise the new American majority. And so if people were sustained in their perverse ignorance of this issue on a moral basis, it will simply become untenable and impractical and unworkable to ignore very, very soon, because America is becoming a dramatically different country. Now, countries have been at this kind of crossroad before. I suppose shortly after whites arrived in South Africa, they looked at the political and social landscape and saw a decision that they had to make. And it seems to me that countries or societies, after they do a great deal of damage to people, are faced with a decision to either repair or repress. Almost invariably, at the end of the repression road, at the end of that decision, is disaster. South Africa chose repression as opposed to repair, and it spelled for South Africa disaster. The early signs are that America has chosen the same path. Repression, that given early indications will get worse in the decades ahead. And so in many respects, I am not optimistic. It seems that the best way to turn this social policy course is to use this argument, this national discussion, not only as a discussion that will help to repair the damage done for almost four centuries to the African-American community, indeed to the African global community, but to the damage, repair the damage to the country as a whole. We've started to privatize prisons in the United States. This ought to be terribly troubling. The only way the value of your stock can go up is to get more prisoners. This state has been a bellwether state in this backward direction. For much of this trend was begun by Governor Rockefeller with the Rockefeller drug laws, which meant that for a conviction, first-time conviction on a nonviolent drug offense, one could go to jail for 15 years, mandatorily. Other states have copied this example. Governor Cuomo got on this bandwagon, of course, with the construction willy-nilly of New York State prisons. And so now you see in states like California, five times the expenditure on prison construction that you would see on university construction. As an illustration of this dramatic new direction taken in the last 20 years in America. Malone, New York, is a good example. It's a small town in upstate New York, an all-white town that reached its apex in the late 30s with the trial of Dutch Schultz, who was a mafioso colleague of Al Capone. And from that point on, Malone began to decline. It lost its Sears, lost its industries, lost its hotel. Town was a dying town. Malone got wind of what was happening in New York State with its prisons and decided, as many states have decided, best way to resuscitate the town of Malone economically was to try to get one of New York State's new prisons. Malone applied. Malone got two. And with it, they got 1,400 new jobs. They got 18 new holes for the golf course. They got a higher census count. Thus, they got more federal dollars. They got better representation in Congress. They needn't have been bothered by control of their politics because those who were in the prisons had lost their right to vote. They were convicted felons. And so the all-white town of Malone, New York, had been resuscitated by two state prisons in which the inmate population was 84% black and Hispanic. It is the modern slavery. And what ought to be doubly troubling, because it is so critical for the sustenance of any real and viable democracy, is that public vigilance has been so small. For the most part, people have concerned themselves with smaller symptoms like racial profiling or driving while black, when the problem has to do with the whole of the criminal justice system, not only how it operates, but on whose behalf it operates. And one has to know that you come to understand public policy well, not just by knowing what happened and when it happened, but why it happened. Who benefits is the question you have to raise almost about every public policy decision, every piece of legislation, every event. Who benefits? And are you able to follow the money? Do you have a capacity to look behind major public policy turns of direction? And when one is able to do that, I think we can understand what this new emphasis on prison construction in the United States signals for the general direction of American society. South Africa, a long time ago, decided on repression. And as the numbers, as the proportion, as the ratio of blacks to whites became more and more skewed, they stepped up the repression. But you get to a point where the society simply implodes. It collapses of its own weight. You cannot put the whole of a society in jail, not even the whole of a generation of young males. And this is what appears to me to be the clear direction that the United States has taken. That's the future. The problem that Americans tend to have is that we are a society of small memory. We tend to think that everything is almost frozen in the present, as if it were a snapshot, without future, without past, without any attribution. And so Americans generally don't like to look for causation. And I think it's because of denial. You think something ugly may be in that past, something that may explain this inequality. And so rather than explain it in a way that would reflect not well on some Americans, you leave the victims to believe that they're in this fix because there is something innately wrong with them. You see, the very value of history, in my view, is this. When I was a young man in school, I guess I was given to believe, because no teacher taught us to the contrary, that history was simply a sort of academic chore, something imposed on us by teachers who I thought must have been sadistic and were doing this because they were powerful and I was not, and they were old and I was young. I don't think I had understood the role of history in the sort of maintenance of the momentum of any society. In as much as, to the extent that you teach the story of the people to the people who comprise just a bit of the story, the forward edge, but you teach the whole of the story, the source from which they sprang, how the story began, and you trace it into antiquity. You give contemporaries in the story a large sense of their own significance. You know, Jews can see back 4,000 years into their history. And it is important for them, and it has given them a kind of resilience in difficult times. It is why we talk ad nauseum in American society and schools about Greek civilization, ancient Rome, all of this, because it gives people a large sense. I remember when the U.S. was raining bombs on Vietnam, on North Vietnam, and we were saying to Ho Chi Minh, who was then in his 80s, that he couldn't win, because the U.S. was technologically superior. And we could turn, after all, Vietnam into a crater. But Ho Chi Minh found this amusing, saying that you forget that we have been fighting for 1,000 years, and we have time. You see, he knew who he was, and his life didn't start at the date of his birth, nor would it end at the date of his death. He had a kind of mortality that was rooted in his story, that with which he was armed. When they ask Gandhi what he thought of Western civilization, Gandhi said, "It's worth a try." you see, the information, notwithstanding one's economic lot at any given time, For one's resilience, one's strength, one's capacity to overwhelm, overcome perfectly anything, always is inside us. 'Tis in our spirit, finds residence in our minds and in our memories. And so it seems to me virtually the worst crime that any people can commit against another people is not just to strip them of their material resources, but is to strip them of their memory of themselves. You can't possibly know where you're trying to go if you can't remember where you have been. And always, for me, one of the troubling things about Black History Month, that I guess several troubling things about it, but perhaps the most is that it is so terribly misleading. That first, as Dick Gregory says, they give us the month with some of the days missing. and then every year, almost ad nauseum, we talk about how many things George Washington Carver managed to do with that peanut. The enormous courage of Sojourner Truth and Harriet Tubman, the brilliant oratory of Frederick Douglass, and on and on, and Malcolm, and we give by implication, to consumers, white and black, young and old, in our community and outside of our community, that this period that represents less than 0.1% of the black story, we give the impression that this constitutes black history. And our young are left to believe that there is no history that they have if they have not been told it, because naturally they've been told all there is to be told. You see, when I was living in Tanzania some years ago, I remember in 1970 walking down the street and I saw a monument, and it was an Askari monument. An Askari means a soldier in Swahili. And I asked somebody, what is that? And they said, this is to commemorate the service of Tanzanian soldiers with the European allies against the Nazis in World War II. And I was 29 years old at the time. I was a bit embarrassed because I said, you mean Tanzanians fought in World War II? I'd read 1,000 books, seen 1,000 movies, heard 1,000 newsreels, but I'd never seen any evidence that Africans had fought in World War II. And which underscores the other thing that is wrong with even the very notion of Black History Month. Because when we think about it, we know that it must constitute an admission on America's part. First of all, for 12 months you have European History Year. And one of the months, the shortest month, you overlay with an additive about the history of black people. First of all, the idea of segregating history is ludicrous on its face. If you teach American history without teaching in that story the story of the first Americans, then whatever you were teaching is not American history. If you teach American history without teaching the contributions of Asian Americans, you're not teaching history. And certainly if you teach American history without teaching the contributions of African Americans in establishing the wealth and power of this country, you are not teaching history. So it must mean what you've done is embroidered some story for American consumption that amounts in the last analysis to some monstrous deceit. Whatever it is, it is not history. Herodotus, the great Greek historian, the so-called father of history, wrote 500 years before the birth of Christ that everything that ancient Greece was, its calendar, its division of the year into 12 parts, its math, its science, its gods, its mythology, all of it had been derived from the civilizations and cultures of Egypt, Ethiopia, and civilizations from the African interior. But I was never told that. You see, my history was segregated and presented to me as a whole when it was not a whole. That thousands of Jewish women in America named Zipporah. Nobody knows who Zipporah. I don't know if they know why they're named Zipporah. Everybody knows who Moses was. I knew who Moses was in utero. Zipporah was his wife. She was Ethiopian and black, as were many of the rivers of the Old Testament. But I didn't know anything about it. Didn't know anything about Cush. Didn't know anything about Aksum. Didn't know anything about Monomotapa. Hadn't been told about Ghana and Sangha. Hadn't been told about Mali and its goal when it underpinned in the 12th, 13th, 14th centuries the entire intercontinental trading system in the whole of the world.
Randall Robinson, author of The Debt, What America Owes to Blacks, speaking about the issue of reparations in African American History Month several days ago at a Brooklyn, New York bookstore dedicated to Africana called Indigo. We'll be back with this speech in just a minute here on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman as we go back to Randall Robinson talking about a trip he took with his son to the mall in Washington, D.C.
We walked the length and breadth of the mall. We did not see a museum, a monument, a statue, a brick, a tablet, a name, not one name etched anywhere to commemorate the 30 million Africans who died on their way in the Middle Passage into America's Holocaust, American slavery. We had been erased from American official memory. Then we walked into the Capitol, and Hazel had noted this before, and she said, when you get into the rotunda, I want you to look up. And I did, and painted on the eye of the dome of the United States Capitol, the symbol edifice of American democracy, is a painting called The Apotheosis of George Washington, painted by an Italian artist, Bramiti, as the Civil War was drawing to a close. And in it, you see Washington surrounded by 60 robed figures. Bramiti painted this to extol the virtues of American democracy and of its first president, George Washington. In front of the 60 figures, you see a banner unfurled, E Pluribus Unum, out of many, one. But all 60 of the figures are white. Then you drop down to the hat band of the dome of the Capitol. You see a gray frieze that runs all the way around, depicting the stages of American history, from the age of exploration until the dawn of aviation. No Douglas, no Tubman, no Truth, no blacks at all. It is as if slavery never happened. And then you drop down the floor level, and the only face you see with a smattering of melanin is that of Pocahontas, who is represented, I think, because she is accepting the sacraments of Christianity in an English chapel. But what you're not told is more important than what you are. The Arco sandstone blocks in which these massive paintings are inserted were mined in Stafford County, Virginia, by slaves, brought up the Potomac River by slaves, put in place, fixed there with mortar, stirred by slaves. Atop the Capitol is a statue called Freedom of an Indian maiden, cast in Bladensburg, Maryland, by slaves. Brought to the east grounds of the Capitol, reassembled, hoisted to the top of the dome by slaves. They were never paid. Forest between the White House and the Capitol cleared by slaves. Foundations of the White House built by slaves. The early buildings of Georgetown University built by slaves who were later sold to a plantation in Louisiana by Jesuit priests. I finished Harvard Law School in 1970. I spent 3 years at that law school, and they have a crest there. I had it as a decal on the back of my car, and across the crest it says, Veritas, Truth. And atop Veritas, you see three baskets of sugarcane. I didn't know what that meant. I looked at it, but never really saw it. I only learned a few months ago that Harvard Law School was founded. Harvard's a very rich place now. It has an endowment of $19 billion. One tends to think that wealth always was. Poverty is somehow preordained. The gap that separates the rich from the poor, written in the stars. Nothing has a past. Everything is in the present. That's what happens when you're stripped of the story. One can't explain the differentials, the inequality, the verticality, the disproportion. And so you're left to puzzle it out for yourself. 30 years went by before I learned just a few months ago that Harvard Law School had been founded by a man named Isaac Royall, who endowed the law school from the sale of slaves on an Antiguan sugar plantation. Mortgage on my house is held by Fleet Bank, a leading American financial institution. It was founded by the Brown brothers, who also founded Brown University, both rich, one an academic institution, the other a financial institution. The Brown brothers got their start to build both, building and sailing slave ships. Aetna Life Insurance Company, the same thing. So much of America's power, both private and public, finds its source, its founding rocks in slavery. You know, one of the problems that we have in, I think, in appreciating the gravity of the crime in general society is that Americans really like to remember things in measurable, consumable blocks. You know, you know the Nazi terror lasted 12 years. The Turkish genocide against Armenians occurred in 1915 and 1922. We can put dates on the beginning and end of what happened in Rwanda, Hutus against Tutsis, Tutsis against Hutus. We can date to Canadian repression of the first Canadians, or Australian repression of Aboriginal people, on and on and on. We can say that it took but a few seconds for two American bombs to incinerate Nagasaki and Hiroshima, killing hundreds of thousands of people. But in any of those great crimes against humanity, no matter how many people die, as long as those who survive can remember their songs, can remember their liturgies, can remember their literature, can remember their poems, can find their mothers, can bury their fathers, can grieve for their children, can remember their languages, can remember their mores, their customs, can remember their cultures, they can put the buildings back up again. But slavery was such a awful crime because it went on in America for 246 years. And in that time, with its asphyxiating patience, it emptied the memories of its victims of everything. Culture is what people lean upon for their very psychic survival. It is the necessary matrix in which human society has to find itself to simply subsist and survive. We lost our languages. We lost our mothers, our fathers, our religions, our mores, our customs. We lost the whole of our cultures, and we lost the memory of what we were and who we had been. We lost all memory of Africa. We lost even the capacity to know that we had had a history that predated the parameters of Black History Month. That does enormous damage. And so it means to me that this reparation struggle is not just for compensation for 246 years of slavery and for the century of discrimination embraced by government based on race which followed it and the economic, colossal economic damage of the entire 346-year period, but for the psychic damage as well. For when I see in Washington, D.C., a poor black child from Anacostia, Washington, going to school, starting school at age 5, perhaps already victimized by lower birth weight, thus lowered cognitive skills, already victimized by protein deficiency, already victimized by lead paint poisoning, already victimized by a father who is probably stands at least a chance 1 in 3 of being under one wing or another of America's criminal justice system, already victimized by a mother who is overburdened with stress, working too many jobs, a home with no computer, no capacity to compete evenly in a fair society. This struggle is for that child. But that child must be made to understand in this discussion that that child is behind, not because there is anything wrong with that child, that what happened to that child happened a long time ago. We must place the blame and the responsibility where it should be. Now, lastly, before I shut up, America tells countries around the world what their moral obligations are. We have told Germany ad nauseum that it must atone. As long ago as the Luxembourg Agreement, pursuant to which a post-war German government began to pay reparations to the Jewish victims of Nazism, until as recently as late last year, when 16 German corporations were pressured by the U.S. government to make $5.5 billion in reparations available to Jews who had been used as slave laborers during World War II. One of those corporations was Volkswagen, and those corporations should be held responsible. The U.S. has pressured Japan to make reparations, which Japan did to Korean women forced into prostitution. We've said this to Australia, we've said it to Canada, we've said it to nations around the world. And the message has been that you cannot be a coherent, you cannot be a healthy society, you cannot maintain democracy in the full bloom of its possible health unless you find the courage as a society to face the wrongdoing of your own past. You cannot bury history. You should never try. And so we praise South Africa for its Truth and Reconciliation Commission. The problem in all of this is that what America admonishes the rest of the world to do, we have no courage as a national society to do ourselves. I do not believe that the problem that America is having with this has anything to do with the award of material resources. Every time a B-1 bomber goes down, you lose over $1 billion in your tax money. Nobody pays it the smallest attention. That is not the issue. The issue is denial. We don't want to talk about it. Don't want to be reminded of it. But we cannot otherwise survive it. To leave both the victims and the victimizers to believe that this inequality has no causation that can be sourced to the history of America is an unfairness to all Americans, unfairness to the contemporary victims, and an unfairness to those who now look at them without an understanding of how this dilemma originated in the first place. And so that is why it is so important for African Americans to pursue this discussion. First, there is a gap in America. For every dollar that a white American makes, a black American makes 73 cents. For every dollar that a white American college graduate makes, a black American college graduate makes 74 cents. For 4 years of college, we pick up one penny against the field. Whites have considerable financial assets. largely because of inheritance laws passed from one generation to the next. But because of slavery and because of 20th century discrimination, blacks have next to none. People in South Carolina didn't know how to grow any rice, and so they went to Sierra Leone and stole the forebears of the Gullah people. They knew how to grow rice, and they came to South Carolina, and they made plantation owners rich. They were never paid, as were not the people who produce the cotton that earned more in resources for the public treasury in this country than all other exports put together. Everybody associated with it from Maine to Mississippi got rich, except the people who produced the cotton. Poverty, like wealth, is intergenerationally inherited. So the hand of history is ever not lightly on our shoulders. Only the fool does not look back for understanding. And so it is important first for African Americans. It is not an issue of what America will do in response to this demand. That is right now beside the point. When you are wronged, you simply, in defense of self, in defense of soul, when you are wronged, you must protest and you must fight. It is no sin to lose. It is only catastrophic not to fight. And so this is what we must do. At the end of this book, I think I say something on the order that I cannot control or predict what America will do. I think we will win in the final analysis. It may not be in my lifetime, but I think we will win. I can't control that. But whether we do or not, the simple making of this struggle will afford us something that is essential to our collective health as a people. Because in the last analysis, if we accomplish nothing else, we will at least have at long last discovered ourselves. Thank you very much.
Randall Robinson, author of The Debt, speaking at the Indigo Bookstore in New York. Tomorrow, I'll look at the Rhodes Scholarships and Reparations. And I look forward to seeing people this weekend at the Houston Pacifica National Board meeting at the Doubletree Hotel. On Friday night, I'll be at the Mecca Center on Kane Street. Democracy Now! Is produced by Terry Allen and Chris Abrams. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.